And good morning once again, and welcome to the other side of midnight. I'm your friendly host, at least I think I'm friendly, Richard C. Hoagland, and I'm going to be your guide for the next 2 hours, back in time. You know, in the 1970s, there was a television show which was an amazing show for me. It was called Connections, and it was co-starred and authored and hosted by a guy named Burke, James Burke. Well, this show is kind of like a Connections, except it's Connections in a much broader time frame. The thing that made Burke's show so intriguing is he was able to relate items and data and empirical evidence that on the surface appeared to have nothing to do with anything that was related to anything. And by the end of the show, each of these episodes, you saw that history is actually a progression of serendipity, of connections between things that, although they look disparate, they look like they're totally disconnected, in fact, are intimately and fundamentally connected, because without the intervening discoveries and the intervening technologies and the intervening insights, what eventually happened probably would not have occurred. Now, I use the term probably because obviously Burke could not prove demonstrably, 100% that the connections that he chose, in fact, were actually connections. It was a logical guess. It was a logical extrapolation, and it made for an extraordinarily interesting story and an interesting tapestry of events and inventions and technologies and developments that most of us have just taken for granted all our lives. Well, James Burke kind of institutionalized the idea of generalism. And if there's anything that I am, I guess, deep at heart, I have been all my life a generalist. With that said, tonight's show, although it looks as if it has no connection to the last two nights, in fact, it does. Because we're going thousands of years back in time to ancient Egypt, and we're going to talk about the land of the real Isis, not the fakes, not the prevaricators, not the horror that's being visited upon the world by this usurper group, which has obviously deliberately chosen this name so that they can instill the opposite sign of what the original Isis and the ensemble of ancient Egyptian gods and goddesses were meant to represent. My guest tonight is an old friend and colleague, Chris Dunn. We haven't done a lot of things lately, but tonight's going to remedy that. Chris has an extensive background as a craftsman. In fact, he began his career as an indentured apprentice. I've got to find out what that means. In his hometown of Manchester, England. So take that, Bob Harrison. I finally got a guy from Manchester on the show. Recruited by an aerospace manufacturing company, Chris immigrated to the U.S. in 1969, the year we landed on the moon for the first time. Over the past 49 years, Chris has worked at every level of the high-tech manufacturing industry, from being a machinist, a toolmaker, a programmer, an operator of high-power industrial lasers, a project engineer and laser operations manager, and much more in that high-tech field. For the past 16 years, he has served as human resources director for a major Midwest aerospace manufacturer who, I guess, wishes to remain anonymous so it won't get, advertising time on the other side of midnight tonight. Chris's pyramid odyssey began in 1977 after he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. His immediate reaction after learning of the Great Pyramid's precision and design characteristics was to consider that this edifice may have been an original purpose that differed from conventional opinion. After further research and study of source material on various theories, Chris concluded that it must originally have been built to provide a highly technical society with energy. In short, the Great Pyramid was a very large machine. Oh, we're going to have fun with this one. Discovering the purpose of this machine and documenting his case has taken the better part of 20 years of research following the 1998 publication of Chris's book, The Giza Power Plant, Technologies of Ancient Egypt, which describes a holistic energy device that is harmonically coupled with the earth and its inhabitants. And I could go on and on, but I won't, because you can read the rest of it on othersideofmidnight.com. And I would recommend that everybody with a digital device with a screen go there right now, click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, because tonight do we have some amazing pictures to share. And with that, let me introduce my friend, Chris Dunn.
Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Good to be with you. How are you?
Well, it's the other side of midnight, and I kind of come alive at the other side of midnight. So, you know, I think, you know, genetically I was made for this, because I've been a night person. Even before I met Art Bell, I've been a night person all my life. I think night is conducive to thinking, and certainly thinking outside the box. And I've got to say that I had never heard of Chris Dunn until one afternoon I picked up my copy, faithfully delivered in subscription, of a magazine called Analog in 1984, in August of 84. And in that issue, which, by the way, I actually wrote for several years, there was this remarkable nonfiction article called Machining in Ancient Egypt, or something like that. And I read it, and it was like the light bulb went on. I looked at what you had done. I looked at the case you laid out, and I said, aha, my suspicions, my intuitions, my feeling that there was never something right with what the Egyptologists were telling us, that these things were just major, you know, huge tombs, that all of this kind of came together. And it started me, in one sense, on the career that I'm pursuing right now, because I don't think without that article, Chris, I would have had the courage to take the next step, which was to look, you know, one step beyond, as John Newland used to say, into the impossibilities of an archaic culture that exhibited such extraordinary mechanical precision. How did you get there?
I got there by starting, as you described earlier, writing the Giza power plant after reading Peter Tompkins' book. And it was while reading Peter Tompkins' book that the light bulb went off, you know, the penny dropped. And I started to seriously try to unravel the secrets of the Great Pyramid and to discover exactly how everything worked. And really, my mission was to find a place or find a reason for every feature that that the Great Pyramid has, to be able to explain it comprehensively within an all-encompassing theory. And so that was my challenge, and that's why it took so long, because I had to, obviously, I had to gather a lot of data, examine a lot of data, had to learn quite a bit myself along the way in order to be able to finally come up with what I consider to be a fairly comprehensive theory about it. But as I was pursuing that research, and I was accessing Tompkins' bibliography, he wrote in one of his chapters about Sir William Flinders Petrie.
Mm.
And Sir William Flinders Petrie was a British Egyptologist, and he was the considered to be the father of British Egyptology. And he was doing research in Egypt in the 1880s. And the book that was cited in Tompkins' book was Pyramids and Temples of Giza, which, I had to actually go to the State Library in Indianapolis and make photocopies of every page. I checked it out. Well, actually, I checked it out, and then I had photocopies made of it. But it was the only copy in the state. And upon reading that, there was one particular chapter which was called The Mechanical Methods of the the pyramid builders. And that particular chapter opened my eyes to a lot more data in terms of how it relates to the nuts and bolts of building a complex technological machine. And it actually related more to my craft or my trade, because it dealt with what I consider to be machined artifacts.
Why don't we stop there and go back just a smidge, because I want people to get a feeling for the expertise you bring to this. I read this quick resume of all the, you know, technological projects and companies you've been involved with, but kind of expand on that a little. What has been your background? What kind of projects have you worked on, and what kind of machining and other technological fashioning technologies have you pursued?
Well, yes, my career throughout my career, I've always been one to learn and push the envelope, and I get bored. I used to get bored very easily until I was able to get into a position where I had pretty much autonomy. I started in a company in Manchester, England, and I served a traditional apprenticeship, which included a lot of handwork.
What is an indentured apprentice? I mean, that sounds kind of medieval.
It is. It's almost like you are indentured in a way that you become a servant. You are indentured to a master, and it does date back to the old Victorian days where, you know, you would have masters that would take apprentices, and a lot of times in the old days, the parents of a child or young man would actually pay the master to take the apprentice and teach them a trade, and the boy would go live with the master and suffer whatever abuse was dished upon him.
Hmm. And we're not talking about present company, are we?
No. Well. Actually, yeah, I mean, the manufacturing, I'm sure if there are listeners out there who have been through the manufacturing shops or, you know, been in factories in 50 years ago, they would relate to what I'm saying. They were certainly, you know, the old guys certainly served out quite a lot of abuse to the young fellas coming in, that's for sure. But in the old days, they weren't paid. So the indenture was that for a period of time, you were essentially the servant of the master, but you did get to learn a trade.
And you basically had hands-on mentoring at every step of the way.
Yes. The mentoring is the most important thing, because it's this is not a theoretical field that you're in. There is exactness and precision involved in it, and there are huge public safety issues in some cases. So especially in aerospace, if you're making parts for jet engines, then the public safety issue is paramount. But like I said, it's not a theoretical abstract field. It's nuts and bolts, and it is... you know, you can have all the ideas you want, but eventually you have to produce something that works.
So you worked with all kinds of materials, all kinds of lathes, all kinds of...
Yeah, all kinds of materials and all kinds of products. I've worked with making electric motors, pumps, generators, even drapery equipment, textile equipment, using lathe mills, boring mills, grinders, all the usual machine shop equipment.
Well, every major machine must have thousands of parts, and somebody has to make every one of those.
Yes, certainly.
So this gave you decades of experience in looking at optical finishes and looking at symmetries and looking at... In other words, you probably could hold something in your hand after a few decades and realize it was either up to spec or it wasn't up to spec.
Yes, it does get it does give you certain attributes in terms of how you recognize precision on a particular object, whether it's a curved surface or whether it's a flat surface. And there is a certain quality, such as, I mean, we could talk today about the automobiles that we have and how they were built in 1974 or the 1970s. And there is a vast difference between the fit and finish and the quality of the vehicles today than there was 40 years ago.
Interesting. Interesting.
And that is because of the, you know, the evolution of manufacturing and the working out of variables in the manufacturing process, which really starts at the basic elements that go into building the machine and how the machine operates. So, you know, the precision and quality is everything.
So with decades of empirical background in machining and how to make complicated stuff and make it fit and make it precise and make it even and make it smooth and make it regular and make it repeatable, when you came to Petrie's work on the pyramid, I imagine you had this, oh my God, how did they do what we can barely do now?
Well, you know, I never say that we can barely do it now.
I'm talking about when you started.
When I started? Oh.
When you started looking at Egypt, not in 2015, but several decades ago.
This is where your leading comments were very apropos when you talk about connections and how things develop, where some disparate fields could feed into another one. And I was thinking about how the evolution of manufacturing has fed into my research on the pyramids and, you know, the artifacts that you find in Egypt, because it is the development of technology that allows us now to talk to thousands of people, millions, I hope, across the world, and to be able to display these artifacts, and they can look at them and examine them for themselves. And then, of course, you know, they can take my word for it of what they're looking at, or they can go out and check it out for themselves.
So what was the wondrous, unusual kind of anomaly in Flinders Petrie's work that really caught your eye?
Well, one of the things that there was so much, because, you know, Richard, when I was in high school and learning about the Egyptians, they were very primitive people. And it showed, you know, the images that they show of the Egyptians at their work, you know, craftsmen, they're using very primitive tools. And then reading Petrie's work, you find out that, well, they were using lathes, sophisticated lathes. And they were also using circular saws and drills. And one particular artifact stood out to me, and that was what he described as number 7G, which is granite means, G means granite, but it was the seventh image in one of his plates in his book.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes a core, a granite core that came out of a hole. And he described it as
I think we have a picture of that on Radio with Pictures. It's number two.
Number two.
Okay, so everybody go to Radio with Pictures, othersideofmidnight.com, click on the upper right-hand corner. That takes you to tonight's guest page. Click on image number two, link number two, and that will give you a nice blow-up. It kind of looks like a slightly tapered cylinder.
And yeah, that's essentially what it is. It's a tapered core, and it's actually a cone shape. If you would continue that lower end on that angle, it would form a cone. But it's a
very long, narrow cone.
Yeah, but the the taper is significant. And the way he described it in his book, he described it as having a spiral groove that along the length of it.
You can see that in that picture. There's those little lines reflecting light going all the way down, very regular, from the top all the way to the bottom, with the core sitting in front of a guy with a latex glove, obviously, to protect the surface.
Right, and that's my hand inside that latex glove.
The hidden hand of Chris Dunn.
Right. So that's core number 7, and it's housed in the Petrie Museum at the University College in London. But at the time I was reading his book, I didn't know where it existed. And, of course, it was a time in my life when it wasn't feasible for me to actually travel very far from my home because of family and work obligations. So
you were still in Manchester when you were doing this, right?
No, I was actually in Indiana.
Oh, this is when you finally came here back in 69.
Oh, yeah, I came here in 69, and I was living south of Indianapolis and working in Indianapolis.
But that's a first stretch to London, yes.
Well, this was a trip to London that I took. And let me explain how that came about, because it's very interesting, the evolution, my evolution through the whole thing. I wrote the article for Analog based on Petrie's writings and also how he described this particular core. And what I found out after doing all my research was that he did not, there were some things that he described very, very precisely and accurately, but others he could have done a better job. And I think that's the case for everybody, me too. I'm sure you feel the same way too. You know, you do your best at the time that you're working on a project, and then you may look at it a few years later and say,
When you're a writer, it's really bad because the damn stuff's in print and it never goes away. And with the web now, it never, ever goes away. So
that's right. That's right. But anyway, based on that article, based on that chapter in his book and how he described it, he described those spiral grooves as being 100 thousandths apart, and which to me was absolutely amazing. Because there's no way a conventional tool could achieve that kind of feed rate, a penetration rate in a piece of granite. Then you're talking about an igneous rock.
How hard is granite on whatever scale you measure?
It's about 7 on the Mohs scale.
Okay, and for people who aren't familiar with that, how hard is it?
How hard is it?
Yeah.
Oh, 7 on the Mohs scale? Well, diamond is 10.
Okay.
Carborundum is about a 9. So, you know, you've got garnet.
So it's almost one of the toughest materials in nature.
It is, yeah. And it's formed in the earth. You know, it's magma at some point, and then it just is an intrusive rock that actually pushes up through the surface.
That's really kind of gorgeous. It looks almost like you could put it on your desk as a paperweight. It's pinkish. It's got inclusions and these weird spiral grooves going all the way down.
That's right. And I asked the curator if I could take it home with me to do that, and he said no.
I wonder why.
I thought you guys were a lot nicer than that. Anyway, no, it's a very precious artifact. He didn't want to let go of it. It's a very interesting piece, and it's comprised of feldspar, mica, and quartz.
So you're looking at this, a very, very hard, one of the hardest materials on the planet, and you're looking at the geometry, and you're looking at this spiral groove which goes kind of like the thread on a screw, around and around and around and around, all the way down toward the bottom. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, as a machinist, what?
Well, I'm saying, how do they do that? And it's still a mystery. And it's a mystery that I've been trying to follow along with a lot of other mysteries. But let me first of all talk about how I came to actually follow up and go to London.
Okay.
I got into a debate on Deja News, the archaeology .sci at Deja News. I was called...
Based on your analog article in 84,
based,
right?
Based on my article, my analog article. And so that went on for months, and it was probably... That was in 1995. They had republished the article in a English magazine and called Quest, and then they'd also published it in Atlantis Rising here in the States. And so in 1995, I had polished off the article and resubmitted it. It was published in 84, and in 84, of course, that was before computers were so, and the internet was so prevalent. I got a couple of critiques in analog.
Mm-hmm.
One from L. Sprague de Camp.
Oh.
Which was rather high-handed and dismissive.
Of course. Well, he actually had written a number of books on ancient technology, and he was generally dismissive of the expertise of ancients.
Well, yes, I mean, but it was a very interesting and acerbic exchange that we had, and Stan published both our letters. I don't know who came out ahead of that, but anyway, I had my say, he had his say, and then it was dropped. But it was picked up as the number two favorite for 1984 of science fact articles in that magazine.
Mm.
And then it was also selected for the analog essays on science in 1991.
Excellent.
With Stan Schmidt as the editor and of the one of the best of the 1984 fact articles. So I was happy about that. But the debate online, whoa, I had never experienced anything like that before. I mean, I was set upon furiously.
Mm.
People, these faceless people that I don't know across the planet.
That's the downside of the internet.
And it's kind of like, and I held my own, and if the post, you know, the thread went on for about 1,000 posts, and eventually, you know, it's just like, well, there's no convincing anybody here. But then I was also the publisher of Quest magazine, was a gentleman by the name of Chris Ogilvie Herald, and he was a supporter of the alternate views. He was a supporter of Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, very friendly with me. I didn't make the assumption that he supported me, which is probably a good thing, because he eventually published a book, had a book published with Ian Lawton called Giza the Truth. And in Giza the Truth, he dismissed my Petrie's analysis. Because I had proposed that they were using a particular method to produce this.
Mm-hmm.
Which I no longer assert that they were using that, but I proposed that they were using ultrasonics.
Ah, hang on there, hang on. Because that's sound, and sound is one of the things we do here. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm talking to my old friend and colleague, Chris Dunn. We're talking about his entree, his baptism of fire, into the idea that the ancient Egyptians had a lot more going for them in terms of machine technology than Egyptologists or sniping critics could possibly concede. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
¶¶
And we are back. Chris, let's go back one moment. How did DeCamp dismiss a professional with decades of machining experience who presents an article which is so startling and so intriguing in its empirical stick-to-itiveness to the actual data and the raising of fascinating mysteries and enigmas? How did he basically, you know, say, you're all wet?
In a very sophisticated way. He essentially started his dismissal by saying, and I remember this very clearly, Christopher Dunn, to the contrary, notwithstanding, the methods of the ancient Egyptians are well known. And then he proceeded to instruct me on what those methods were. So, I mean, you know, it was his view. I know that he'd written a book called The Ancient Engineers. In fact, I had it in my library. And he also is an engineer. He graduated from engineering school. But I think he spent most of his career writing. So I'm not sure that he was a practicing engineer or...
Well, what was the thing about your analysis that bugged him the most? Because I know the thing that resonated with me, pun intended, was you came up with a tentative idea of how ancient Egyptians could have produced a spiral groove of that precision all the way down this core, which is basically the center of a hole. It's what happens when you pull out the center of the hole and you're left with a concavity in whatever you're drilling, right?
Correct.
So this would be basically something you would throw away. And Petrie found it among a bunch of other detritus somewhere on the Giza Plateau, and it struck him that it was weird and unique and bizarre and inexplicable from the viewpoint of a 19th century guy. You're looking at it with 20th century eyes, and Sprague DeCamp, who has the advantage of both perspectives, he dismisses your work out of hand because we all know, we're authorities, remember, that the ancient Egyptians couldn't have done this way. So what was the point that he got really bugged about?
Well, I think it was essentially, the title of the article was Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. And, of course, that culturally, I think, for him and for even Petrie in his time, I don't think that would have been a bridge too far as far as proposing that the ancient Egyptians, who we all know are backwards and primitive and used copper chisels and stone balls and wooden mallets and to build pyramids, we because that's all we found in the archaeological record, so then obviously all of these wonderful, sophisticated artifacts that they created must have been created using those tools. Oh, wait a minute. Those tools aren't very efficient, but the Egyptians had all the time in the world and all the people. I mean, they could muster, you know, a huge workforce.
When we're looking at image two, the close-up, because you click on the image on Radio with Pictures and that takes you to an enlargement that Rich has put up for us, those grooves, did I hear you correctly that those grooves that are glinting in the light are 100 thousandths of an inch apart?
They turn out not to be that precise, which essentially kind of puts the ultrasonic method in doubt. What I measured, they were between 50 thousandths and 120 thousandths. It was, and in a follow up article that Petrie wrote, a paper that he had published after his book was published, he wrote more about this particular core, and he had to leave the question because he couldn't explain how it was made. No method that was proposed was satisfactory, but he described it in that paper as being like a drunken screw because it just meandered all over the place. And so that's what I found in 2003 when I went over there and took some measurements.
So if we go to image number three and we click on that, that's a quadrilateral display of four images of you looking intensely at this core.
Yes, and I'd actually enlisted the help of a gentleman by the name of Malcolm McClure, and he was a retired geologist from British Petroleum, and he developed an interest in this particular artifact because it was something that he had not satisfactorily answered the question as far as how it was made. And of course, being a geologist and going around the world for British Petroleum, he would know what technologies would be employed today to pull a core out of the earth, right?
Mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
that's one of the methods they use is they retrieve a core out of the earth and study it. But I was first to actually put the thread around it, and I followed the groove as faithfully as I could.
Wait, you mean you took an ordinary sewing thread,
exactly,
and you wrapped it around the core, having the thread fit into the grooves as they went around and around and around and around and around and around.
Exactly, exactly, and I figured that was a foolproof method for me. And the intention was to get a few measurements and also to prove Petrie correct that the spiral was actually, the groove was actually a spiral and they weren't horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm, he was surprised to see the thread, wrap around in a spiral because he didn't know what to expect. But then...
And no one had thought to do that before you?
No.
Isn't that bizarre? Why didn't Petrie do it?
No, what Petrie did is he took measurements from one of the ends of the core and around four places at 0, 90, 180, 270 degrees and recorded those measurements. No, I know. In fact, before I flew over to London, I pondered how I should actually do this. I was thinking about, well, I need to make a gauge where I spin this on a gauge, and I have a follower, that goes along.
This is based, of course, on your decades of mechanical background and all that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Some engineers would have actually done that, I suppose, but I'm pretty cheap.
and thread is cheap. Okay, what are we looking at in image number four? It says latex impression.
Okay, let me first finish this this experience with Malcolm, because we. I looked at him. He got impatient with me, and he was concerned that I was affecting the trajectory or the path of the thread based on whatever desires the outcomes I want to see.
In other words, he thought you were putting the taper in the spiral grooves in by the way you wound the thread on the core.
Right, I was affecting the outcomes,
right,
rather than the outcome being an honest and true reflection of what the artifact was. So, I was fine with that. Malcolm, why don't you try it? And so he took the thread, and you can see him in the bottom two photographs.
Okay, on number three, the bottom two.
The bottom two, and he's intently going at it, and. After he had finished, satisfied himself, so I looked at him and I said, "Well, Malcolm, what do you think?" And he looked at me and he said, "I'm speechless."
Wow, an honest guy.
Yeah, he was speechless. But even with that, and actually writing it up after I got back to the States and putting it on my website, I still did not satisfy my critics because they thought that was just it wasn't a a valid method for inspecting the groove.
Hmm. Having a continuous mechanical thing like a thread.
Right.
And having it rest in each groove as you go around and around and around. And then you obviously take pictures of that and you look at it from different angles and you can measure between the threads. And they reject it. Well, there's an old cliche. You know, those convinced against their will are of the same opinion still.
Yes. It's a good one. But anyway, and I thought, well, you know, I can see where that argument might actually resonate with some people if they're of that mind. And so it would be a good idea to actually get be able to display the surface of the core.
Okay, so that's where number four comes in.
So let's go to number four. And this is a latex peel, latex impression. And I had the curator and the conservator at the Petrie Museum make this latex peel for me.
Did they kind of give you any problems? Like you want to dip our core in what?
They were fine.
Oh, good.
No, the curator was an Egyptologist by the name of Stephen Quirky.
And you're kidding.
He was a very, very fine gentleman. They were very, very courteous and very helpful.
No okay, complaints. So what we're looking at in number four is a negative, because if you it's like making shoe prints when you see crime shows where they pour plaster in. So all the ridges are really grooves, and all the grooves are really ridges on the original.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's the reverse of the core.
Okay, but it's a faithful reverse. In other words, it's like a photographic negative. It's exactly the image, except it's in reverse.
Exactly. And so what I did, while it was still in the tubular state, I cut two notches, or two little squares, on the outside of it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then I sliced between those squares equally, so that when I laid it out flat, you would have a half a square, four half squares on both edges.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at...
It's kind of like unrolling a tablecloth.
Right, exactly. So if you take a tube and you cut a square in it, and then you cut along the length of the tube and through the square, and then you fold it out, then you've got two half squares. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the intention was to line up those edges on the squares, on the half squares, and then compare the grooves to what a horizontal groove would actually give you, which would be a straight line, or at least a groove that would start close to the square or on the half square and end exactly on the opposite side on the other one.
Right, symmetry. It would
meet itself.
Right. If the grooves on the core were basically horizontal.
Exactly. If it was horizontal, then the groove would meet itself, and it would be
a ring around the core.
It'd be a ring. It wouldn't be a spiral, and all the critics would be right, and Peter would be wrong, and I'd be wrong.
But you found.
Well, there it is.
Image number four, close up, click on it.
Image number four. And you can see where the approximate center line of the groove is, but it's definitely a spiral.
It's a spiral, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel.
Exactly. So all the criticism, you know, people hate to have criticism, but it's so helpful because it pushes you to go just a little further. And gather a little more information, which can end up to you know, absolutely invaluable to you. So this is invaluable information, not just the to be able to demonstrate that it was a spiral.
So there is a continuous spiral in the granite, in the in the almost hardest material on Earth, that's continuous from the top of that core to the bottom of the core without any breaks other than, you know, surface scratches and abrasions from handling and all that. And you proved with this method that that damn thing is a spiral. And what was the reaction of you, and what was the reaction of your geologist friend, and what was the reaction of your critics?
Well, the critics are silent on it. I haven't heard anything from them. My reaction was, you know, I mean, there's a certain satisfaction. I knew it was a spiral. I mean, the methods that I haven't been, in engineering shops and, you know, engineering departments for 30 odd years or 40 years without having some kind of abilities to, you know, be able to use an instrument and understand, you know, the results that it gives me. So it's, you know, I wasn't really surprised. I was happy that I was able to show it. But I, the other features on it were more surprising to me. The other features that don't really pop out at you when you're looking at the granite core itself. And I began to realize that the whatever tool penetrated that granite, it was nothing conventional that we could even, I mean, even if you had a even if you said, okay, we've got this, you know, kryptonite tool, we can penetrate the granite at 100,000 per revolution, and it will come out looking like, you know, you were just cut a thread on a lathe, very clean.
So you're saying that the depth of the groove varies between 50 thousandths and about 120 thousandths.
The distance between each groove, what you would call the pitch on a
thread. So what about the depth?
The depth is about 5 thousandths in places, and it goes from, I would say, zero. Even the places where it is barely discernible, you can still see the witness of how the tool and where the tool passed over the material. But the significant part of the surface finish is it's a bloody mess. I mean, you look at it, you've got grooves flowing from between the threads, you know, so you have all these holes. And
no, the surface is not smooth. It's not smooth.
It's
very irregular.
It's and it's almost like Petrie wrote in the book that it was almost some of these quartz was actually ripped out. He wrote that the tool had cut deeper in the quartz than the feldspar, which was you know, normally the opposite would be the case because quartz is the harder material. So, but when you look at the, when you start to examine the surface, you know, with this latex peel, there's no regularity at all. And you have these flows. It's almost like a flow from one thread to another. You know, they go vertically or at an angle, and certainly not precise. But the other part of it that is most interesting to me too, and it's something that I did not even consider until I was able to examine this more closely, that is the surface finish and how it compares to the surface finish of a granite core that is produced using the methods that Egyptologists tell you they used.
Which takes us to image number 5.
Which takes us to image number 5. And that is and image number five, the top two photographs are ancient core marks. What the left, the upper left is a hole, a drill hole, and the upper right is a drill hole.
Like a photograph taken through a oblong magnifier.
The left one was, yes.
Okay.
The one on the right, actually the one on the left was taken by Patrice Pouillard, who's a French film director who directed the film Revelations of the Pyramids. I think it was about 2008 film.
Mm-hmm.
The one on the right I took, but I used a macro lens so that I could get a close-up of this particular hole, because...
So you're looking down the hole in the one on the top right.
Yeah, this is actually, the hole is actually, you have to look at it, it's upside down. It's in a lintel block over some doorway in the Valley Temple.
Okay.
And this is one of the holes, this is where the actual core came out of. This is how the hole that was cut, that core came out of. And that's on near the Giza Plateau, the Valley Temple. So these are ancient holes. And on the bottom right is a hole that was created using copper and quartz sand.
Which is what Petrie thought that they may have used to actually create these.
No, he didn't even entertain such an idea. He dismissed it because he didn't think it would work.
Oh, that's right. He was saying that diamond had to be used.
Yes, he thought diamonds. He thought that there was like 3 tons of weight put on the diamond.
Mm.
Quickly, but though the quartz, after my article was published in 1984, there was another article published in 1986. And I believe it was in Antiquity magazine, but it was published by a gentleman by the name of Dennis Stocks, who worked with the Manchester Museum, and he was demonstrating ancient Egyptian methods of cutting granite, and he had actually published a book called Experiments in Archaeology. And a part of that book, it was some of his work on drilling holes and the cores that came out of them. And I communicated with him. I tried to actually get a good photograph of his work so that I could compare it to the ancient Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, you know, you're not good. I mean, if you're going to satisfy a customer that your product is identical to the one that he asked you to produce, then, you know, you have to show good evidence that it is.
You should be able to do a side-by-side comparison.
Side-by-side. And in this case, it was the surface finish that was the most important, not necessarily the dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to see the surface finish. And he wouldn't send me anything.
Really?
No.
I wonder why.
And the photograph in his book is not clear. He has a distant shot of the core and the hole, and it's not clear.
So a professional engineer writes him and says, I'd like to compare the ancient Egyptians to your modern simulation, and he wouldn't send you any data.
Right.
Hmm.
Basically, essentially, he advised me to create my own.
Oh, nice guy.
Right, so I did, and there it is. Yeah, and as you can see, that you don't have the grooving.
No.
That you do on the ancient ones. But there's another thing that I noticed, because, you know, I've actually handled that core, the core number 7. I've had it in my hands, and I've looked at it, and you can see it. And the surface finish on this hole that I made in the core, it was just like a matte finish. I mean, it was not polished. And the the core seven actually is. It has almost like a burnished finish to it.
You mean whatever tool was used to create the groove, which was part of extracting this core from the granite hole that was actually the intended purpose, left a high polish in this incredibly hard granite as it drilled the core out.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
And also, the grooves themselves, the latex peel, the grooves are not rough. I mean, they're smooth, too. And those little bubbles that you see are smooth. So it's almost like they were using some method to melt the material as they plowed through it.
See, the thing that struck me about the analog piece is you said, based on several parameters, and you can obviously expand if you want, that you could only foresee in 1980s technology that some kind of ultrasonic drill that was vibrating the drill head very fast, you know, thousands of cycles per second, as it was cutting into the surface at a much lower speed of what, maybe an inch or two an hour or something like that, could create this kind of grooving. But you said a moment ago that you kind of backed off from that based on actually physically looking at core number seven.
Yes. Yes, the ultrasonic satisfies, you know, the method satisfies the creation of a hole and a core where the cutting action is actually the reciprocation of the drill in terms of it, you know, it vibrates back and forth and it chips away like a jackhammer. And the groove will be created by the method used to advance the drill into the material. In other words, you're using a screw and nut to drive the drill forward. That screw and nut, the thread pitch, would be reflected in the groove in the hole and the core.
Okay. So what accounts for the difference in surface? The polished, you know, ancient Egyptian artifact versus the matte or rough finish for your simulation in the 20th century, 21st century?
Right, exactly. It means that the methods proposed by Egyptologists is wrong, and we still don't have an answer for that particular core.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we say around here, in reference to artifacts on Mars and on the Moon and all that stuff, that it only takes one white crow to prove all crows aren't black. So if you can prove that no conventional or posited ancient Egyptian technology with you know, brass or bronze or, you know, carborundum or sand or quartz or whatever could do what Petrie found, and of course this is not the only core that's been found in Egypt, what's left? How did they do it?
Right. And that's where experimenting with more sophisticated methods and machines start being introduced. But my objective was to actually throw out a challenge and to point out that the methods are inadequate.
You mean the proposed methods by Egyptologists are inadequate to explain what they're looking
at? Right, they're not accurate, and it, not just on this particular artifact, but on most of the other artifacts too. Some of them that we'll discuss.
This is so cool. This is just so cool. You know, we actually blown past the break, which I don't want to do. So we will take our break now that you've totally captivated me in terms of what we've been talking about. My guest this morning is Christopher Dunn. We're discussing machining in ancient Egypt, incredibly sophisticated machining that obviously from the empirical data you've been hearing cannot be replicated in terms of the Egyptologist's favorite methods that have been proposed for over 100 years. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back with Chris Dunn. We're talking about something that should not be possible. What Chris demonstrated in the last half hour is that everything we think we know, Egyptology knows, science knows, about how the ancient Egyptians did some of the simplest, stupidest stuff, like drilling a hole in a piece of granite, cannot be correct. How did you feel? I mean, that sounds like a stupid television question. How did you feel when you had the proof that you were right and they were wrong? And I don't want to, you know, make it seem that black and white, but that's basically what it comes down to.
Yes. Well, I mean, I felt vindicated to a certain degree. I expected that, you know, other people, my peers, other engineers would appreciate the work and the information. And so I put it out there, and I've got some extremely positive feedback on it.
Oh, tell us about that, because when Graham and John Anthony West and Robert Schock published their Giza Plateau analyses of the dating of the plateau and the dating of the Sphinx and all that, they had a lot of support in the geological community when they did that geological society meeting. I forget what year it was. Mm-hmm. But I haven't really heard, because I probably haven't been keeping as much track of you as I should have, I haven't heard what other mechanical engineers, other people who work with stuff, with materials, with real things, think when they read what you have found.
They essentially agree. You know, one of the things that somebody said to me at one time is that, you know, it's a bit risky. Isn't it a bit risky for you going out on a limb like that?
And I said, the risk-averse reaction. Okay.
And I said, well, it's a risk no matter what you do in life. And I suppose, you know, when I started down this path, the only blowback that I feared would be that my compatriots in the engineering field would call me up and, or, you know, would say, oh, Chris, you know, you need to be admitted somewhere. This is crazy stuff.
Or even worse, did you notice you made this really, really stupid error here, so everything you said doesn't, you know, in other words, you are always doubting yourself when you're way out on the edge of the envelope.
Right. But now, here we are, it's 84, oh, 30 years later.
My God.
And the conversation, you know, is completely changed. Everybody is talking about ancient machining now.
Except for the Egyptologists.
Well, I don't expect them to, you know.
But see, they're the ones that have the corner on the, this is how we interpret Egypt. See, the problem we have in science is that we have these separate guilds, because they really are still guilds.
Yes.
And each guild kind of owns its own piece of territory. So the multilateral, you know, generalist perspective, which is you kind of relate a lot of different things to try to figure out something, doesn't seem to enter into the minds of a lot of these experts, because you can have this guild say, oh, it's got to be this way, and that guild says, oh, no, it's got to be that way. And how does a general public person decide which guild, which expert is correct?
Exactly. Yeah, there. I mean, it is entrenched in those particular fields. They're very rigid, and I don't know how you actually change the mindset of those people. Shortly after my book was published, the Giza Power Plant was published, I was contacted by
what year is that again?
1998.
Okay.
I think it was in like 2004. I was contacted by a gentleman in England who had just started to go to a university college, and he was taking an Egyptology degree. So he wanted to become an Egyptologist, and he had picked up my book, and he was very interested in my ideas. And was actually doing his thesis along the same lines, though probably not as not as out of the box as I am, but he had approached his professor and asked him if he could actually take his master's of science rather than, you know, an MA, because the path to an Egyptology degree is a master's of arts rather than a master of science.
And now that's telling.
Isn't that telling?
It's very, come on. How can you have a science if you don't have science?
Good thinking, yes. It's because it's become more of a religion. And it's, you know, the whole field of Egyptology is heavily immersed in religious belief. I mean,
maybe I should revise my categorization. Maybe it isn't a guild, it's more like a cult.
Well,
am I being too cruel?
You know, I don't know. I have never entered into those hallowed halls of Egyptology to rummage around to find out whether you're right or not.
Mm.
I mean, I have really wanted to. The one Egyptologist that I did, I've met a couple, but the one, you know, Egyptologist that I met, it was certainly off-putting in terms of entertaining new ideas, and that was Zahi Hawass.
Mm.
So.
Tell us about Zahi. Tell us about your interaction with Zahi.
Zahi is a very charismatic and charming gentleman who is, can get very frustrated and dismissive. He's a typical autocratic, Arab fellow. But he can be very charming, especially if you're accompanied by a young lady. And I was fortunate in 2001 to go to his office with a young lady called Gail Fallon, who was a producer for Grizzly Adams. And they were doing a documentary, and I was involved in that in Egypt. So Zahi gave us, you know, permission to go to go into the pyramid and to go into the Serapeum.
Oh, wow.
Which was the first time I've been trying to get into the Serapeum for years, because I went in there in 1995.
Now, the Serapeum is nowhere near Giza, though.
Well, it's at Saqqara, which is around 20 miles away.
Right, right. It's north of, I think. South of Giza.
North, I think.
Is it north? I'm sorry, you're right. It's
I think it's back, yes. But the... But at Saqqara, there's this...
that's the one with the so-called step pyramid.
Exactly, yeah. What they call Djoser's Pyramid. There are a couple of pyramids in that area, and some very interesting features at that site. But we got permission to go into the Serapeum, and that's where I was able to apply some of the precision instruments that I brought with me.
So that's image number 6.
And that's image number 6.
Again, go to othersideofmidnight.com, go to the upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you to tonight's page. Scroll down. Scrolling is good. Go to number 6. Click on that. There we are. And that's you in the funny hat. With this weird gadget that you're holding up on the side, the inside of one of these huge, coffers, coffins?
Yeah, they call them sarcophagus for the Apis bull. And they're enormous. The boxes weigh about 70 tons, and the lid's probably 25, 30 tons.
That's a locomotive.
But there are about 20 of these that have been housed in these crypts that have been cut along these underground passageways.
Underneath the so-called step pyramid?
No, not underneath. No, it's not underneath the pyramid. It's off. It's off to in a different location.
No, but I mean it's underground.
It's underground. Cut into the bedrock.
Okay.
Cut into the bedrock. I first went into this place in 1995. Following Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall, they were doing a documentary. I think it was in February of '95 with Netherlands Television, and it was while Graham was finishing off his Fingerprints of the Gods. And they had invited me over to be interviewed inside the Great Pyramid.
Had Graham read your stuff?
Well, I had sent Robert a copy of the analog article.
Ah, excellent.
And so he got excited about that. He sent it to Graham, and then Graham called me. And,
smart guys.
And then the Roel Oostra of Netherlands Television called
me. Well, you see, Robert is also an engineer.
Yes.
He's a building engineer. He's a construction engineer.
Civil engineer,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So they were actually filming in there, and I was just tagging along in the background, trying to keep out of the way. But there was this one coffer, and these things are contained in these crypts, so you have to go down the steps because there is a recess cut in the floor that is about 3 or 4 feet deep, and then the boxes are inset into another recess in the middle of the crypt.
Wow.
And so I jumped down into the crypt, and I ran my hand across the surface of this.
Now, are these made of granite as well?
Granite, yes, and basalt. There's one up down there that's made of basalt.
Volcanic rock.
It's a volcanic igneous rock. But the interesting thing is there's over 22 of these things.
Holy cow.
That were cut down.
And they weigh 70 tons with 30-ton lids.
Yeah, 20 to 30 tons. They're huge. Anyway,
so what are you doing? What are you doing in this photograph? You're holding something up to the side.
Well, what I wanted to know after 1995, I had a very small straight edge that was very precise. It was ground to within 2/10,000ths of an inch, which is it's a very, very small dimension. You know, you take a human hair and cut it 10 times.
Oh.
And this
tool, this straight edge, is made of what? Titanium, steel?
Oh, hardened steel.
Hardened steel, okay.
And putting it on the surface and moving it around the surface. I was expecting some imperfections, and I couldn't find any. It was very, very smooth.
Oh, no, wait. You're holding a flashlight.
Well, this is a different time and a different box. I could only do a very limited cursory inspection, and then I had to leave.
You mean when you're with Graham and the Netherlands TV crew?
And so it was. I actually had to get back there and do further examination. So I went back in 1999, and I tried to get into the Serapeum, and I was told, no, they're closed. It's too dangerous. They're not letting anybody in. And I took my tools with me. I was all prepared to gather some data. But then in 2001, I went there with Gail Fallon and Grizzly Adams, and then we talked to Zahi Hawass. He gave us permission to go in there.
Okay.
So went in there, and I had with me a longer straight edge, which you can see on the lower right side on that ledge there with the holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
That was ground with it. That was precise within 1/10,000ths of an inch.
So it was twice as precise as the one you used earlier.
Yeah. What I'm holding on the underside of the lid is a toolmaker's precision square. And the blade is a 14-inch blade. And it was calibrated to within 50 millionths of an inch.
What?
And it's extremely precise. These are the tools that tool makers and gauge makers use, and so you know they're very, very precise. So what you see there is a very polished surface. The straight edge, the blade of the square is
That's sitting, the long part.
Right. Sitting flat against the wall, the inside wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the base is on the underside of the lid.
Okay.
These images right here, I don't know how much I can stress how important these images are in terms of showing you the smoking gun.
In other words, your white crow.
Another white crow. Another one. And then we'll talk about another one after that. But yes, definitely the white crow here. But the what you find is a condition that, if you consider it geometrically, the surfaces that the blade is set against are opposite each other. So this is one, the picture on the left is one side of the box. The picture on the right is the opposite side of the inside of the box.
Okay. And how big are the boxes? How far are the walls apart?
Yeah, the boxes on the outside measured are about 13 and a half feet long and about 7.5 feet wide. And with the lid on, I think they're about 13 feet high, something like that. But the what you see there is something that is extremely precise and square, but geometrically and dimensionally, both those surfaces, in order to achieve that condition, those opposing surfaces had to be perfectly parallel with each other.
Holy cow. In a material that's one of the hardest materials on the planet.
Granite.
Done by a culture that ostensibly used copper and chisels and dolerite balls, basically stone balls, and pounded mm-hmm. things. And you're looking at a surface that's almost of optical quality.
Yes, yeah. I don't know quantitatively exactly what the tolerance is, or you know what the tolerance band is, if it was ultimately mapped with more sophisticated equipment. But just with my craftsman's hand and eye, and just the feel of running the steel across the surface, there was no difference that I noted between what I am seeing here, what you're seeing here.
So that angle between the wall and the lid is exactly 90 degrees.
Exactly 90 degrees. And what I was trying to say was that there's no discernible difference between the surface of this object and the surface of a precision granite surface plate that we use in manufacturing shops today.
As a kind of a calibration tool?
Right.
Okay. And this is across the width of, what, 7.5 feet, you say?
Well, it'd be a little less on the inside. I would probably say about the walls, I think, about 16 inches wide.
Okay.
So, yeah, you take off a couple of 2.5 feet, 3.5.
Okay, here's 5 feet across. Here's the question.
Yeah.
How do they do it?
Well, that's an excellent question. And, you know, the methods for creating flat surfaces are very well known. It's called lapidary.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, you know, working a surface down and then applying a lapping plate or and going back and forth using a particular grit, and then depending on what surface finish you require, you use a finer grit until you can come up with a almost perfectly polished surface. But
come on, here's the big but.
The concept, you know, when we come to address the question of how, there's all kinds of answers, but the question of why becomes a little more complicated because if you the the purpose, the so-called purpose for this box is, was to bury a bull. A dead bull, which was revered in ancient Egypt. It's called the Apis bull.
Right.
And...
but why would you need almost optical perfection on a scale of a 70-ton object to bury a carcass, even of a revered creature? What was the practical reason for the incredible precision that you are measuring in these images?
Exactly, and that's what the data prompts. It prompts those kind of questions because
among everybody but Egyptologists, of course.
Right. Well, I mean, optically flat surfaces, precision flat surfaces, just don't come into existence coincidentally.
Oh, come on. With enough time and enough slaves and enough, you know, quartz, come on. You know, Sprague de Camp, he could answer this in 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, I can design a time machine in my head, too.
I think a guy named Wells beat you to it. But anyway, so, all right, let's leap ahead and speculate, okay? The classic Egyptian Egyptology analysis is these boxes were used to bury the Apis bulls, right?
Correct.
What if that was a secondary purpose long after whoever made these incredibly precise boxes had long vanished from this planet? What if they had another, much more interesting purpose?
Oh, well, now you're getting into the nitty-gritty of the whole thing.
That's the point of the show.
Because... and because I don't have the image up here.
But oh, darn.
I know. But, you know, the curious listener and reader could see it in my book.
And you have a website, by the way.
Yeah.
And are these images on your website?
Yep.
And many, many, many more?
And quite a few more, yeah.
Okay, so give us...
articles and...
Okay, give us the URL of the website.
www.gizapower.com. That's GIZAPOWER.com.
And that is also a hot link in your bio on your guest page on othersideofmidnight.com.
Right. But your question is actually, I think, one of the more pertinent ones, and that is the theory of adoption.
Mm.
When older cultures pass and younger civilizations or cultures arise and or actually migrate into a particular area or, you know, come in and beat back whoever living there and take over, then they leave their traces and personalize what is there to suit themselves. And there's a lot of evidence that that's what the ancient Egyptians were doing, because all of these artifacts that you see here, you can see it at Giza, at the Sphinx enclosure on the Dream Stela, and also in Luxor on the statues. You'll find these beautifully inscribed sunken reliefs with perfect form and perfect finish. And then there may be some area on the artifact where you find really, really crude symbols and hieroglyphs and designs. And this is what you find in the Serapeum.
So you have two different cultures, one incredibly sophisticated and ancient, 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 and then one really, really crude, but more recent, recent, recent.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Exactly. So
so somebody borrowed or adopted or stole, of course, how can you steal from a culture which is long gone?
Yeah.
So what you're basically saying is these measurements were building a case that ancient Egypt was not one period, even in terms of the Egyptological kingdoms and all that, but there was a much bigger span of time and a much more incredibly sophisticated technology applied to this very hard material. And that the later Egyptians that we're familiar with basically kind of adopted them as they found them.
Exactly. And, you know, if you're looking, it's like the question of where the machines are.
That made all this stuff.
Where the tools are. And, you know, the rest, I mean, what we're looking at now is just the skeleton of a civilization. The flesh and blood and the brains behind it, they're long gone. Well, the brains, I mean, they that's reflected in their monuments. But the time span of, you know, how did the civilization disappear? How, say, a machine tool, a lathe or a saw, how long does it take to degrade, to erode? Is it done by nature, or do men come along and repurpose them, you know, cannibalize them?
Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Christopher Dunn, and I've left you on a knife edge. According to his own empirical measurements, the precision, as Petrie once talked about, optical precision on the scale ultimately of acres, if you add all the artifacts together, is demonstrable in the work of Chris Dunn and his own measurements. The real question is, who did it? When did they do it? How did they do it? And the most important question, why did they do it? And Egyptologists don't seem to have even approached those crucial, crucial questions. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. And we are back. Chris, again, that stupid question. What did you feel when you were measuring stuff that was impossible by any standard Egyptological explanation?
Oh, boy. it was an amazing feeling. I mean, it was like a eureka moment, a rush. You name it. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know, and there were so many of these moments in Egypt. That Serapeum, the boxes in the Serapeum. I was shocked. I mean, I was absolutely dumbfounded. I'd never heard of them. I know that John Anthony West wrote a little about them in his Traveler's Key to Egypt.
Right. An amazing book, by the way. I heartily recommend John Anthony West's A Traveler's Key to Egypt.
Yes, an excellent, excellent guidebook. There was nothing in the popular literature about them. There was a couple of articles, I think, in scholarly articles written about the Serapeum. But I think it was Mariette, who's the French Egyptologist that actually excavated it. And he had his notes transposed or translated or copied out by an assistant, but he had lost most of them. So the provenance of the site is very murky. It's very difficult to get a clean handle on, you know, just what the steps were in terms of excavating and studying the site, you know, how that was done. It seems like people just went in there and started, you know, taking things and moving things about without any, this was back in a time when Egyptology or even archaeology had not really solidified in terms of any you know, protocol or scientific discipline.
Well, it was more like Indiana Jones stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I felt like Indiana Jones, except without.
Except I think he's got a cooler hat. Come on, Chris, you got to get a better hat.
In place of the whip, though, I had this huge square hanging from it.
Okay, let's go
you
to.
You don't like that hat.
I get all right. You know, it keeps you from bumping your head on the granite. Yeah,
I, I, let, I don't I just wear that to confuse people because I don't fish.
Ah. Okay, let's go to image number 7, because once you found that these boxes, these 70-ton boxes, and they're called sarcophagi, but that, of course, is, again, a kind of a general term that Egyptologists apply to anything that's a box in Egypt, and there's no clue as to whether these things ever were used to house, you know, bodies when they were constructed. They may have held bodies, i.e. of the bulls, much, much later, thousands of years later. But again, we're back to the question, why would someone build in an advanced culture, why would they build boxes of this incredible precision? Why would you need such precision? Or is it pure ego? Is it just someone like you, except from a much more advanced culture, just flaunting what they can do because they can do it?
Well, I'm sorry, Richard, but I don't think it happens that way.
Okay.
The precise surfaces, in, you know, as they have developed in our society or civilization, weren't really necessary until, you know, they started to develop printing presses.
When you have mechanical surfaces wearing against each other, you've got to have precision, otherwise the damn thing will freeze up and fall apart.
Right. So there was a purpose behind them. You know, the machine beds on ways, these CNC and lathes and you know, other machinery. Flat surfaces were critical to those, you know. And so it wasn't really until we had technological reasons to develop them that it was even conceptual.
But wait. Suppose you had a robotic technology and you had some kind of a, not a laser, but something more like a phaser, where you're actually interacting with the material at the atomic level, and the robot doesn't know how to make something that looks bad. You tell it to make something, it's going to make it as perfect as it knows how to do, because that's what it's built to do. So the perfection is kind of an offshoot of the technology that was used, but maybe it wasn't needed to be that precise. That's just the tool they had to use.
Well, that's exactly the point that I make in my articles and books.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Though I think you probably stated it a lot more eloquently than I did. But yeah, you're right. What essentially you have is you have the question, okay, if they were to do this by hand, then they had to have had some special reason for it. They had to have had a technological reason for it. In order to spend that much time and effort to create these things by hand, even if they could create them by hand.
Which is a totally separate question.
But the only other reason would be, as you stated, is that their tools were capable of nothing less. and that is actually a reflection of the condition of manufacturing, or the, you know, the history of manufacturing. Whereas at one time in the past, when I started at my apprenticeship, they had what they call fitters. And the fitters would take a piece that had been machined, and then they would finish it, or actually file it, or lap it, where inaccuracies may exist that were inherent in the machine, in order for it to function properly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not needed, because the machines are, you know, the worst quality coming out of the machines today is as good or better as the best quality that came out of machines 50 years ago.
Amazing. Amazing. You know what John West said about Egypt, though?
He said a lot of things.
Well, the really big thing that captured my attention and actually got me to take him all the way to NBC to do a special a couple of decades ago, he said in Serpent in the Sky that Egypt appeared, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember the exact quote, but he says Egypt appears not so much as a development as the emergence of a full-blown technology like when we have cars, you know, you have Packards, yes, and Model, right, T's, Packards, right, Cadillacs, Lexus, whatever. Right. But in Egypt, it's like you've got this in reverse. You've got incredibly advanced, sophisticated stuff that you have demonstrated by the measurements, mm-hmm, at the very beginning, ancient stuff, and then stuff gets progressively worse as you come forward in time.
Exactly. And, you know, John Anthony West has a wonderful turn of phrase. He has some really cool sayings. You know, he says about the precision and the accuracy, it's like finding a Porsche where a horse and cart should be, you know. Mm. And he's right on that.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time.
Actually, he will segue us to the next slide.
I was just going to say, let's go to 7, because 7 is even more amazing.
Yes.
Click on number 7, Other Side of Midnight, Radio with Pictures.
I'll give you a very brief background on this little history. 2006, February 2006, I went to Egypt on one of John Anthony West's tours.
Mm-hmm. And, isn't he an amazing tour guide, though?
Oh, he's great. Yeah, we got along just famously. He's a fabulous, fabulous guy. Really liked him, and very entertaining, very enjoyable tour. And the guests that went with him also were extremely enjoyable. Really nice to be around. But on this tour, at the end of the tour, I was going to meet David Hatcher Childress. Mm. He was coming to Egypt to do some filming. He wanted to film me on the Giza Plateau. So, you know, he's another guy that's cheap and likes to save some money. So if I'm already there.
Oh, yes, of course. Target of opportunity. Oh. Has he read the analog piece?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, so while he was there, I had heard about Abu Rawash, a site that was about 5 miles away from Giza, and I had never been there, but my friend Stephen Naylor, who was another researcher in this area, had talked about it. And so I was interested. So David and I go get a taxi, and the place isn't open to tourists or visitors. But we were able to access the site. And
was this through your connection with Zahi?
No, actually not. On that trip, I actually paid him a visit down at the SCA office in Cairo. That was interesting, but that's another story for another time.
Yeah, we don't have time. I want you to talk about Image 7 here. This is amazing.
Right. So David and I went out to Abu Rawash, and
now that's the site of a pyramid that was really totally destroyed.
Yeah, they call it the Lost Pyramid for some reason. And I had actually climbed it. I was walking around the top of this truncated pyramid, and I would look down at the courtyard below, and I saw what I thought was a flat block of granite, and of course, you know, I had seen so many other flat surfaces in Egypt. There are artifacts on the Giza Plateau. I write about them in my book. They're colored photographs and drawings and stuff.
You mean you actually got used to finding super flat surfaces in ancient Egypt?
It does wear off after a while.
Gone are the goosebumps. Okay, continue.
No, I carry on about it, but I worry sometimes that other people may get a little tired of me carrying on about it. But I climbed down a pyramid to look at this granite block, and you can see it in image 7.
It's number A in the upper left-hand corner.
Right. And it turns out that this is not a flat surface. I was expecting a flat surface, and you know, I wasn't given a flat surface, so that makes it even more interesting to me. And so, as I looked at it, and I looked down on the surface of it, I see that it has a curved radius along the top of it.
So it's like a section of a cylinder.
Yes, exactly.
Like you'd taken a glass,
right,
and you'd taken a diamond saw and cut out a chunk of the side, so you had a curved outside and a curved inside, and then you have the edges where you made the cuts.
Right, except the bottom is flat, but this the same. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's like the chord of a circle.
Well, but you mean the bottom of this thing is not curved to match the top?
No.
Oh.
No. And
oh my God, that's even more difficult.
Exactly right. You got it. And then the top, when you're looking down on the top, you see on the image B, there is a radius where the granite had broken off. So the tool had terminated or stopped cutting at that point, and the granite was broken off from there on out. So essentially what you have is a compound radius. So the radius is going in two directions.
Oh my gosh.
Right, so the tool is cutting it on an angle. Either the tool's on the angle or the workpiece is on the angle. But then as I looked at this, I was thinking, well, I had to figure out how they did this, you know. First thing I need to do is find out what radius that is.
And how sharp or how shallow the curve is.
Exactly. So using the chord length and the chord height, calculated the radius on both the cut surface and also the break to find out what those radii were. And it turns out the the radius was a hell of a lot bigger than I thought it would be. It was about 43 feet.
Oh, my God.
And then I think, well, what? How could that be 43 feet in diameter?
And we're talking a piece of granite, again, one of the hardest materials on the planet.
Right.
And it's not styrofoam. It's not light.
No, it's granite. But then as I thought about this, I remembered back in the day when I was working as a toolmaker at Indianapolis, and we needed to cut a larger radius with a smaller tool, and we'd kick the tool on an angle, and we'd essentially be cutting a partial ellipse, but it would show up as a larger radius. And so that's when I concluded, well, what they had done is they'd used a saw that was tilted on an angle, and that created both the radii on the surface and also where the saw terminated. But what the size was it calculated out to be just over 35 feet in diameter.
Three stories high?
Yes.
Holy cow.
And, of course, you know, the thoughts going through my mind were, how the hell did they fixture that thing, you know?
And how do they power it?
Why it? How do they power
this it? This isn't 100,000 slaves on treadmills. Come on, how do they, and you're cutting granite.
Yes, but look at figure F.
Okay.
And do you see the striations on that?
Oh, yes.
Yes, those striations are about 30 to about 50 thousandths apart. And
like those on the Petri core.
Yeah, they pretty similar to the Petri core. And so the tool was obviously it was advancing fairly quickly in terms of conventional
through granite.
And that's through granite.
In other words, you're talking about like a hot knife through butter.
Mm. Well, I said that, you know, in my article on the Petri core, that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, arguing that copper would cut granite would be like saying that butter could cut aluminum pan. <you know? laughs> So, but this is another smoking gun. Petri
another white crow.
Another white crow.
Yeah, smoking guns are very cliche.
Sorry?
Smoking guns are very cliche. White crows are in.
Well, I'm just going to have to update my vocabulary.
The Apaches in New Mexico would love you, yes.
White crows. As long as they're not red herrings. But, you know, this is the thing, is it's just absolutely amazing. It's totally unexpected.
And okay, so the surface itself, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but we don't have a lot of time, and I want to make sure people really understand. Did you find the same polished surface over and between the valleys and the ridges of the grooves on this piece of granite?
Yes, very, very.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Yeah, very smooth surface. And, you know, where it came from, a couple of things that I did work out, though, the saw could have been housed in one of the trenches. There's a trench close to where this piece is located. And they have traditionally been called boat pits.
Called what?
Boat pits.
Oh, boat pits, okay.
Yeah. And this one is no exception. They call it a boat pit, but it has the shape.
Based on the two so-called boat pits found on the flanks of the Great Pyramid.
Well, that's another story. There are pits. The boats were found in rectangular
pits. Were they built to house the boats, or did the boats become opportunistic boat burials by a culture that came much later that said, oh, this space in the ground looks kind of neat. I guess I'll put something in here.
My God, you must have been looking over my shoulder when I was writing my book. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I identified those as being saw pits, and you know they house the saws in these pits, not only at Aberoash but also on the Giza Plateau.
So let me get this picture, and I think we can go to E as a kind of a metaphor, because that's a profile shot of this granite slab showing the curve in one direction.
That's looking down the center of the cylinder.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. You're saying that if you looked at this stuff, if you were standing at ground level and you looked at this stuff sideways, you know, standing like a man looking at it straight on, mm-hmm. half the saw would be above ground mm-hmm. and half the saw would be below ground in one of these pits.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or maybe less than half below. You would have, you know, you'd have to have accommodate a shaft and
machine, whatever, and powered
pillar,
it and all that.
Pillar.
Okay, but a good portion of this huge 30 plus foot wide saw is spinning below ground. Did you have any idea of how fast it would have spun and how rapidly it could have gone through the granite?
I have absolutely no idea. I can imagine, though, at 35 feet in diameter, the revolutions the surface feet per minute would be more important than the revolution. The revolutions would determine the surface feet. So it would be rotating slowly, but it would be the surface feet. And then whatever technology they were using in terms of the cutting medium and whatever other assist they may have had, such as ultrasonics, which is known to make conventional cutting easier. I mean, they do ultrasonic assist drilling and also cutting.
Okay, we only have about 2 minutes left. I know, okay. It's gone really quick. Stand back and give me your big, big, big picture. What do you make of Egypt now versus what you thought when you were reading as a kid about Egypt way back then?
Well, it's Egypt. In my vision of Egypt in the past was a very, very high society, and I think they, you know, on their major projects, obviously, they had some mega projects that they were accomplishing with the pyramids and the temples. I mean, they built their tools to match the project. They were building big, their tools were big. One of the points that I try to make is, and this is what the biggest mystery is, how Egyptologists can cling to the theory of a culture that can last for 3,000 years and not improve their tools one bit over 3,000 years. And that's what they try to teach us, that they were using copper tools and wooden mallets and stone balls to build the pyramids, and also towards the end of that civilization in the 18th, 19th dynasty, they were still using the same tools.
So their approach, really based on, again, your empirical engineering measurements, is completely out to lunch.
No, I mean, yes. You can't, it's like, you cannot have brilliant engineers who are designing these products and dumbass tool makers who, you know, don't even know how to build a good tool. It just doesn't happen, you know.
Amazing. Unfortunately, Chris, we are at the end of the 2 hours, and we will obviously be talking again. It's gone really well, it's gone really fast, and it's gone much too quickly because I have so many more questions, and there's obviously a lot more evidence. The only thing I can say is, and the connection with the programs we've done earlier in the week, is that this whole terrorism bit, taking on the persona of one of the ancient Egyptian goddesses, Isis, is such a demeaning desecration of the culture and the people and the talent and the engineering exemplified by what you found. They're not even on the same planet. And so culturally, I'm wondering why we are giving obeisance to groups that have no business even in the shadow of such a name. Chris Dunn, my guest this morning, I want to thank you for a remarkable 2 hours. You've been on the other side of midnight.
You're welcome.
My name's Richard C. Hoagland, and remember, until tomorrow morning, same time, same channel, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.